Hello and welcome to this course on making chaos work for you, keys to successful small firm management. My name is Enoch Bartlett Sears. I'm the publisher of Business of Architecture, and this course was originally recorded as part of the 2014 Business of Architecture Summit. This course is registered with AICES. Credits will be reported for AIE members, and certificates are available upon request. Making chaos work for you, keys to successful small firm management. Rena M. Klein, FAIA, is a nationally recognized expert in small firm practice and author of The Architect's Guide to Small Firm Management. With 20 years of experience as the owner of a small architecture firm and over 10 years as a consultant and educator, Rena brings a special understanding of design firms managed by entrepreneurial architects. Rena is the 2014 chair of the National Advisory Group for the AIA Practice Management Knowledge Community, and also the executive editor of the AIA's The Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice, the 15th edition. For more information, you can go to her website at rmklein.com. In this course, you'll learn how to better leverage the favorable aspects of small firms while overcoming their challenges. You'll also see this through case studies and emerging practice models, as well as a list of available resources to help your practice succeed. You will build skill in firm development through increased understanding of management theory and its application to small firm practice. You'll explore how to leverage favorable aspects of running a small firm practice while also meeting the challenges of an unpredictable business environment. You'll do this through case studies, and you'll also gain knowledge of the resources available to help you succeed. With that, I'll turn it over to today's presenter, Rena M. Klein.
But I decided to go back to school and learn more about running my business. I learned a lot of things, not just about running my business, but that to my surprise, there was this whole discipline of management, the whole theory and history and ideas that could really be helpful when running a small firm. So when I graduated, I felt compelled to share my knowledge with my small firm colleagues and to help them, you know, make more money and feel more satisfied in their work. So I started teaching and consulting with small firms. I wrote my book on small firm management and was fortunate enough to be tapped as the editor of the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice. So that all brings me here to share with you some insights that I've gained, particularly to share some aspects of management theory that are especially applicable to small firm practice. As Kurt Lewin, who is a famous person in management history, once said, there's nothing as practical as a good theory. And I think most architects would agree with that. So, next slide, please. That brings me to discussing the context, environment, and the atmosphere we work in currently in 21st century realities. The new normal shaped to a large extent by globalization and the Great Recession that we're just coming out of. And to understand how to navigate the unpredictable environment we work in, where seemingly anything can happen at any moment, we need to start by understanding the macro environment that we operate in. And essentially, this means understanding what's going on around us in terms of trends. The ones that seem most important to small firm practice I'm going to discuss today, which are technology, integration, demographics, and economics. Next slide, please. Technology, particularly mobile capabilities and long-distance collaboration, have significantly changed how we can work. It really allows small firm owners to work on all kinds of things that weren't possible before, like huge projects as part of a global team. And it also allows for virtual offices, having employees that are not co-located, and which allows for access to people and skills from anywhere around the globe, essentially. There are many different ways that this kind of access to technology can increase our reach and increase our capabilities as in our new world, and it includes, you know, the emphasis on entrepreneurship, the ability for each person to reach out and be able to offer their contribution to a wider audience. So next slide, please. Technology also increases our capacity in terms of project delivery. And those who are facile with BIM or virtual design and construction, software like Revit or ARCHICAD, have the ability to deliver projects more effectively and have capabilities to integrate real-time analysis into the design process. So for small firms that open jobs, the ability to basically produce a whole lot more than we might have been able to in the past. And it also opens up new avenues of specialization and expertise. An architect I know in Chicago named Aaron Grevin, for example, is a specialist as a BIM coordinator. He helps teams of architects, builders, and consultants coordinate their use of the 3D model through every phase of design and construction. And by the way, there's an excellent article in the 15th edition of the Architect's Handbook of Professional Practice on how small firms can successfully transfer to using BIM technology in their firm. And there's another one also on the processes of project management and how they're impacted by using BIM. So the next trend in our industry, which is on the next slide, please, is a movement towards more integration in our practice. Small firm owners are collaborating with other small firms, with bigger firms, with builders, to more effectively serve clients and to respond to a more competitive marketplace. Now, this is a real shift from the traditional architecture firm, which works in a very fragmented way, each individual unit doing its own work with the team made up mostly of people who are there co-located in the office with them. Now we have a movement towards joint venturing with in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of forms. And this graphic I've got here up now, it comes from an architect named Gustavo Berenbaum of Miami, who regularly joint ventures with some of the most well-known architects in the world, such as Zaha Hadid. He's very proactive in that he identifies projects in his community and identifies the star architect, perhaps, who might be interested in working on them, and creates a joint venture as the executive architect, and he's developed quite the reputation for working with these kinds of high design firms to get projects built in the local community. And when you talk to him about this, he talks about how much that has expanded his ability, the kinds of projects that he can be involved in, and the complexity and interest of the projects that he can be involved in as a small firm. And you might note that in his model, there's never a moment where one of the firms isn't involved. Even in the beginning, the executive architect will be involved to some extent, and at the end, the design architect will also be involved. Another example, next slide, please. I'll hold the mic. Another example of integration is SLAM Collaborative out of Connecticut. They're a fully integrated firm offering a one-stop shop for their clients. Now, they went this direction because they realized that the separation between design and construction was causing them countless headaches, reduced quality of the final project, and higher costs for their clients. So they decided to change the way they worked and provide a single point of responsibility for their client. And as a result, they talk a lot about avoiding costly redesign late CM selection and poor quality of workmanship and value engineering that erodes the quality of the project. All these things are short-circuited by having an integrated project delivery process and an integrated firm that delivers both design and construction to their clients. Okay, And the next slide, I talked about another trend, which is demographics. And that, of course, is extremely important with the millennial generation, which is almost as big as the baby boom generation beginning to enter our potential workplaces. And with the boomers retiring, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. But right now I wanted to focus on the impact of the younger generation coming into our firms and the many skills and some challenges that they bring. Their confidence, but they can also have a lot of self-doubt or worry. They're optimistic and they're open to changing, experimenting. They're generally achievement-oriented, warm and outgoing, and tech-savvy and open-minded. All these qualities that are really positive for our firm. Although there are some downsides too, and as mentioned on the slides, and many of the baby boomer principles that I talk to. Talk about both these aspects of their younger employees and how there are some challenges to really allow these young people to contribute fully to our practices and to have a 360 mentoring so that we can learn from them as well as teach them. And this is important because the generation in between, the Gen Xers, are actually quite a small generation, about half the size of the baby boomers. And many of the Gen Xers were lost to our industry during the recession of the early 90s when they found other things to do. So architects in their 40s or mid-40s are a bit of a rare breed, and they're really the next generation of leadership in our firm. So what's beginning to happen is that some of these younger people are leapfrogging into leadership and leapfrogging into new kinds of ways of doing our practice that are very both stimulating and potentially disruptive. So integrating younger generations into firms is becoming extremely important and, in fact, a competitive advantage as we move forward. Okay, next slide, please. And then, not to be forgotten, certainly not least, are the economic trends that are in the macroeconomic environment that affect our practices tremendously due to the fact that our industry is a cyclic industry that tends to go up and down with the business cycle. And this graphic shows the construction business cycle, which moves from boom to recession to recovery. And in many places in the country, we are in recovery now, not everywhere. It's kind of spotty. But if you're experiencing increased rents and increased funding for construction, you know that you're kind of moving towards the boom market. And if you're actually in a boom market already, maybe in some of the project types that you do, say townhouses in a market like Seattle, or multifamily housing coming into a boom sense, know that soon that will be overbuilt. So even while you're benefiting from the boom in the project type you might be in now, you have to think about the fact that may be ending at some point soon, and how can you diversify or leverage what you know to do other types of projects that may not suffer so much in the next downturn. So I just put up here a few statistics that are basically the result of patterns that exist in the macro economy. And you'll note that we have a big tendency to go towards self-employment and be as sole practitioners, three times that any other occupation. That our median pay is in the $73,000-$75,000 area. And most interestingly, I think that employment is projected to grow by 70%. So that's about 10 or 15,000 over the next 10 years, creating around 1,500 jobs a year, And we graduate about 3,500 architecture students a year. So you can do the math. There really is an art position for every architecture student. But as you know, education in architecture prepares us to do many kinds of things. But our industry, is still recovering and has a ways to go before it's going to get back to the numbers that existed in times past, where we had more like 120,000 architects working in the United States. However, and next slide, please. Our employment outlook is improving, and we are definitely in a total macro way beginning to see an upturn in our economy. Okay, next slide, please. So what does it have to do with chaos and managing our own small firms? This picture is Hurricane Sandy, and it might as well be a metaphor for the Great Recession's impact on our industry. Hurricanes and recessions are recurring events that have clear patterns but are not really predictable. So when certain conditions exist, you know, a hurricane will always occur, but it's impossible to know exactly when these conditions will exist. Hence this notion that chaos is order without predictability. In chaotic systems, such as hurricanes, they're defined as unpredictable, acting in nonlinear and complex ways, as systems in which small influences can create huge unexpected effects. So according to the principles of chaos theory, you can never tell where a system is heading until it's been observed over time. But over time, there's an inexplicable tendency towards order and repetition, and patterns emerge even from the most chaotic circumstances. So the macroeconomy is like that, hence the recurring business cycle, and so are the unpredictable environments in which we run our firm. Next slide, please. So over time, scientists who observe hurricanes have been able to note patterns that enable them to predict the general course of a hurricane like Sandy. Something similar is possible in our firm. We are constantly collecting data and creating knowledge through doing our projects, collecting, sorting, and analyzing that data and knowledge, and noticing the recurring patterns that are produced is critical in effective small firm management. For example, do you know your hit rate? That's the percentage of proposals that you put out that you actually land as jobs. Do you know what types of projects or which clients lead to your most profitable jobs? These are examples of patterns that can inform you in your business decisions. So noticing patterns over time gives firm leaders an improved sense of what's going on in the firm and what to do about it. So this is always preferable to reacting to a single circumstance that might come up, no matter how significant it might seem. Next slide, please. So this brings us to the first key to small firm management, which is noticing patterns. Next, please. So here's a diagram that diagrams a somewhat common pattern in architectural firms that I've noticed over time. Starting with the principal always being out of the office, and most project management being done by the principal. Then you come up to the principals are overworked and underpaid and stretched, and that leads to a lot of things. Principals are bottlenecked in the construction process. The amount of face time is reduced between the principal and project managers. There may be a tendency to micromanage. There may be a lot of redos and wasted efforts and reinventing the wheel. There may be last-minute changes that involve, deadline production that wouldn't be necessary otherwise. And all of this adds up to the possibility of staff being unsatisfied and there being staff turnover and no time for planning and even less time for, hiring someone new that you feel is really good. And so you have these vicious circles that occur in firms, and you can actually diagram them and think about what could we do to improve a situation like this, and we'll be talking about that a little bit more later. Next slide, please. And one similar to the hurricane scientist, you basically need to mine your data to uncover the patterns in your firm. An easy way to do this is a chart that displays your net operating revenue, your total expenses, including salary, but not including direct expenses, those expenses directly related to projects. In other words, direct expenses are those expenses that you would not have if you didn't have projects to do, such as consultancy. So make sure to subtract these direct expenses from your gross revenue, which includes payments you've received for direct expenses. That's how you arrive in your net operating revenue, the amount of money you actually have to operate your business. So when you subtract your expenses from your net operating revenue, you get a profit or loss before distributions or taxes. For this analysis, it doesn't matter if you count, if you do or you don't count your owner's draw as part of the salary expense. The trends will show up regardless as long as you're consistent. Either count the owner compensation as part of the salary expense or don't. So I've included a handout that's an Excel spreadsheet with which you can create a chart like this for your firm, which I think Enoch will email to you after the event. But this chart is actually my firm over the earlier parts of its existence. And you'll notice that there's some things happening before 1996 when I went back to school that are not very positive. No matter how much work I had, I was still having my profit go down, down, down. This is not a happy pattern. After I went to school, I was able to turn things around and increase my profitability along with my net revenue, keeping my expenses stable, and that's kind of what you're looking for in a positive pattern when you generate this chart for your firm. Okay, next slide. So a lot of the problems that we have in our firm are not easily solved with linear thinking, which is diagrammed at the top of this slide, where A makes B happen and B makes C happen and it's predictable and we have the same answer every time, like machines work, input, something happens, output, same every time. But in the complex world we live in and in the complexity of the organizations that we're in, we need to apply a different kind of thinking than a systems thinking, where A will influence B, B will influence C, but maybe C also influences A, or maybe there's an outside influence that is affecting the system. So we have to think of things in a more complex, and this is all understandable to designers because we know that designing is systems thinking, because we change any one thing, everything is affected. And it's the same kind of thinking that we need to apply to our organization. So next slide, please. So this is a simplified diagram of the first one I showed you where everybody was dissatisfied. And this diagram was generated because when I work with small firms, I've heard over and over again project architects complain about principals always making last-minute changes to the drawings. And these changes cause rework and deadline crunches. I say, 25 drawings need to be changed because of one small move of a wall. Now, this kind of situation could be caused by inadequate one-to-one communication between the principal and the project architect during the course of the project, by the principal's need to micromanage, or perhaps the project architect's lack of experience, or maybe it's a combination of all three. Yet if this situation happens over and over again, it has results. reduced trust between the principal and the PA, reduced productivity, possibly reduced quality of work. So if you begin to diagram what's happening in your firm over and over again, you can begin to see these recurring patterns and begin to see how to make it better. And here's a few options to make those situation better. Routinize your quality review process so things don't get out of the office without being checked no matter what. Next one, please. Routinize daily rounds. Make sure that the principal, even if you're out of the office a lot, checks in with the project architects or the project managers or your virtual contractors, virtual workers, daily or routinely, a few times a week. Try to make this happen as regularly as possible so people know when they can ask you questions and when effective communication can happen. As much as possible, transfer the daily project manager from the principal to the project architect. So they're the one who's dealing with the client. They're the one who's dealing with the everyday changes and can take a little burden off of the usually overburdened principal. And last but not least, trust is the opposite of control. So maybe question your need to micromanage and think about, you know, why you hired this person and mentor instead of manage and delegate instead of do, and let the talented and intelligent people that you hired, you know, do the work that you hired them to do. Okay, so as a summary of this first point, to notice patterns, understand patterns emerge over time in unpredictable systems, that data collection, it will give you the information you need to make good business decisions. Notice things. Have you seen this before? Things happen over and over again. See what the usual outcomes are and are the processes working over time. And most importantly, next slide, please. Understand that in small firms, it's so determined by the habits of the principal, and basically your habits are your destiny. So identify what we like to call core incompetence, which means that the kinds of things that maybe you're not so great at, and see if you can improve them, could have huge leverage in the effectiveness of how your firm is run. You know, some people deal with this by finding a partner who's good at what they consider their own weakness, and that can be a good strategy. You know, in a typical scenario, you might see a design partner who's gifted in creativity being paired with a managing partner who's great at organizing and running a business, and this can work, although it doesn't improve the core incompetence of either partner, and it may result in organizational incompetence, like a misalignment of values or a confusion of purpose or mixed messages from staff. So you need to be, understand how you can have an alignment of values and purpose if you have that kind of partnership and arrangement. However, make sure that you look at your own abilities and see if there's anything. For example, I worked with a client who was really, really poor in time management, and that affected every aspect of his operations, meeting with consultants, meeting with the staff, meeting with clients, made things very unproductive, even to the point where his staff turned back the clock in the office to try to make the principal get to meetings on time. So you can imagine how things would be improved if there was a little bit of self-inspection, introspection about improving that kind of issue. Okay, so go on now to the whole firm system. Now, I've noticed in my work that there are many types of problems and issues in firms that are very common. So be sure what you're experiencing is not unique. And some patterns are so common that they're almost archetypal. And I have diagrammed this as an example of the universal influences to productivity and hence profitability. These are job satisfaction, time management, and communication effectiveness. Now, productivity is shown in the middle of the diagram because productivity is always going to be the main concern. Increase productivity, you increase profit. Simple as that. So the most important influence on productivity in our firms is job satisfaction. Now, happy people work better, and when work is going better, people are happier. You have this wonderful reinforcing loop. And the principals have to be included in this notion as well. Or if you're a sole proprietor, understand that your career contentment has a lot to do with how well you're going to produce and how really good your work can be. So job satisfaction and productivity have a very strong reinforcing relationship. But this can turn into a vicious circle overnight if people are dissatisfied and unengaged. So the next slide, please. The influences on job satisfaction are issues about opportunities to design interesting projects, and secondly, autonomy, the ability to control over one's work. So now you can understand why we have so many sole practitioners, because that gives us ample opportunities to design and all the autonomy we'd ever want. But employees need that as well. So think about how you can give design opportunities to the people who work for you and how you can give them more autonomy and more authority in decision-making over their own work. By the way, this list was generated by a sociologist named Judith Blau, who actually studied architects and what gave them satisfaction or career contentment. And the rest of this list I don't think is anything startling, except for perhaps optimal variety, the need to be able to keep learning and be challenged and have new things to consider, as well as be able to do things you've done before and do them better and better. Next slide, please. Now looking at this diagram again, we see the two aspects on the top, time management and communication effectiveness, as the balancing or limiting factors in this system. Because if no matter how enthusiastic and willing our staff is to work hard and keep things going well, they're not going to be able to do this if there's inadequate time management or poor communication. If they're constantly coping with that, they basically get burned out. People are willing to commit, work hard, work all night, work late hours, but if they continue to have to do that, they won't be happy for very long, and you have this vicious circle of job satisfaction going down. So in terms of time management, here's a list of some tips that you might think about. I always advise people to create some quiet time. You know, even if you're working alone, you know, don't answer your phone, don't look at your Facebook page, don't check your email. Set aside a couple of hours, 2 to 3 hours a day, where you can really focus on your work. And if you're working with other people, that's a good time. That's a good thing too. I mean, we all can see who's calling these days, so if you have a contractor who's pouring concrete, of course you'd answer the phone. But interruptions really reduce our effectiveness, so choose carefully. We're not emergency architects on call, generally speaking. So create some quiet time for yourself, routinize contact with project architects or with, even with your clients. If you're using a virtual office situation where you have people working for you who are not co-located, established protocols are very important. Document and storage systems, obviously regular staff meetings. There's some things that you need to communicate face-to-face. You need to stay current with people about how they're feeling. Check in frequently and see if things are going well. Give them feedback and you know, don't use technology to avoid personal contact. It's effective, but it's not I think we went on to the next slide here. No, go back. go back one and go back another one. I'm still talking a little bit about time management. I wanted to say something about excessive perfection. There's a difference between excellence and perfection, and we all want to strive for excellence, which is relative. You're doing it excellent compared to other things. But perfection is an absolute, and you can never reach it. So if you're going for perfection, you're probably doing more than is actually necessary for excellence. So make a distinction between that. I think we can go on to the next slide now about communication effectiveness. So understanding what can be sent by memo, what can be done by email, and what requires face-to-face contact is very important. So having staff meetings, having face-to-face contact, and having virtual office protocols helps to make all of this effective. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. So communication effectiveness, time management, job satisfaction is all very important. But they're all mitigated by how effectively we do our work processes. And by that I mean is how the work actually moves through the office. Next slide, please. So when you do your revenue, expense, and profit chart, if you come up with a chart like this, you may be revealing poor productivity within your firm. Because what this is showing is that no matter how much gross revenue or how much income you're bringing in or revenue you're bringing in, your expenses are going up in parallel with that amount of revenue, and you're making the same amount of low profit at the end of the day. And you have to question whether, in this chart, whether, you gained anything in 2003 by doing so much more work than you did in 1999. So if you're seeing this, you really need to look at your work processes to understand how to be more effective at getting your work done and making more profitability. So next slide, please. And that brings us to the second key, which is routinizing the routine. And part of this is understanding that there are four different kinds of work. Not all work is the same. And there's two qualities of work. The first is analyzability, which is whether you can describe a type of work by a memo or a step-by-step process, step one, step two, step three. So some processes have high analyzability and some have low. Then there's the quality of work that's variety, high variety versus low variety. So obviously routine tasks are tasks that are basically the same every time and can be understood by step one, step two, step three. Whereas engineering processes are also analyzable. You can get the answer to sizing a beam by step one, step two, step three, but it has high variety, different loading conditions, different beam materials, different support conditions. So engineering processes have high variety but high analyzability. Craft processes are low analyzability in the sense that you can't describe it with a step-by-step process like doing a watercolor rendering or doing casing around, finish trim around a window. You need experience and skill, and you get better and better at it the more you do it. But it basically has low variety. It's basically the same process every time. Now we have non-routine work in the upper left-hand quarter, which is low analyzability like design that requires experience, intuition, creativity, inspiration. So the point of this analysis is to understand that there's a difference between non-routine and routine work. If you're doing non-routine work, you should and your staff should do it their own way if you're doing routine work, you should do it the same way every time. And a key to understanding how you're going to increase the productivity in your work processes is to identify the routine processes, do them routinely, and identify the non-routine processes, let them be done by the people who are doing them in the most effective way. And craft kind of in between, understand that it's something that can be routinized. A lot of the processes are the same, but it takes experience and practice to do it well. Whereas engineering tasks, we generally delegate to others. So next, now the other aspect of routinizing has to do with knowledge management, with understanding what to do with all the information and data that we gather in the routine day-to-day work of our practices, and organizing them into four repositories, as I've shown here, will help you organize your server in such a way that it will make sense. Everybody can find what they need, that you don't have a million duplicate templates that have been changed over the years. It's a really good exercise to take a look at your server and to reorganize it in a way that is really effective in terms of finding what you need to do the work, the routine work quickly. Next slide, please. Of course, if you do the routine work quickly, then you have more time for the non-routine design-oriented work that we all love to do. Now, I'm just going to quickly go through this. This is a list of administrative functions that are almost always an area in which you can routinize the processes in your firm. Next slide, please. This is a diagram of what can happen if you aren't careful about getting the administrative work that you need done, like getting invoicing out. If you don't do that, you can end up with having cash aging receivables and a cash flow problem. If your administrative breakdown causes people to be sort of short with their clients, you can have unhappy clients. You can lose potential project opportunities, and the whole workings of your office really depends on the smooth working of these routine aspects of administration. And of course, there is software that can help you a lot with these, accessible on the web at a fairly low price, or enterprise type software that can integrate your project management and accounting and tracking of key financial indicators in a way that really gives you a good handle on these routine administrative processes. Next slide, please. So I just want to mention the importance in terms of routine work of keeping timesheets and of timesheet discipline and keeping track of your billable hours, your direct hours on projects, and the other kinds of work that you do, how many hours you spend there in order. And of course, you need this for payroll, if you have any, or for understanding how much to invoice. But you also need it to gather data for information about future proposals and for understanding how your firm is doing in general through key financial indicators. Okay, a summary slide about routinizing the routine, to treat routine work and non-routine differently, to pay attention to processes, to create standard methods and procedures and forms, to practice time sheet discipline, and the last one is monitoring capacity utilization, which is about making sure that you have the resources that you need to get the work done, whether that means an extra computer or extra pencil in some cases, but having, if people are all hanging around one computer that has a seat for a certain kind of software and waiting to be able to use it, that's a capacity utilization problem. Now, for example, today I had my iPad as well as my computer. My computer didn't work, so I can use my iPad to watch Enoch put up these slides, and that's a good example of having a little excess capacity when you need it. So that brings us to step three, the third key to small firm management, which is self-aware leadership. And it leads us back to our original premise and the third key to effective management of small firms. Now, in small firms, we are completely formed by the proclivities and the interests and the skills and the capabilities of the founder, or in if it's gone on for a while longer, the principals and leaders of the firm. And as I mentioned, the person who had terrible time management, you know, if they could change that, everything in the firm could potentially change. So the proclivities of a leader becomes critical in how a small firm operates and lasts over time. Now, this slide we have up here is about the general firm life cycle and how firms that usually move through, especially if there's no second generation leadership that's developed or wanted by the firm leader. On the other hand, next slide, if we're inclined to share responsibility and authority with others, it's possible to grow the value of the firm and transfer leadership to the second generation. And according to some Harvard researchers, most entrepreneurs reach a point where they have to decide whether they're going to be rich or be king. Now, there's nothing wrong with being king, but you have to know that if you want complete control over every aspect of your firm, it's going to limit what you how big your firm can be, because you may only grow to 6 or 7, and it may limit your choices on retirement. So if on the other hand, if you can begin to allow second generation leadership to reinvent the firm and bring in some junior partners, you have the potential to create value in your firm and have some other options than retiring. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to have to go through this pretty quick because I'm running low on time here, but just take a quick look at this slide and you can see that your choices increase if you're able to gain value in your firm. If you go through your entire work life and come to the end of the point with nobody being your successor, it's very unlikely that anyone is going to want to buy your firm from you without your involvement. So thinking about all of this at least 10 years before you want to retire is going to be very important. All right, next slide, please. So your level of comfort, your leadership style, your level of comfort with allowing staff to have more authority and decision-making is really going to be determinant. It's going to be a design criteria for your firm. So looking at this chart, you know, think about where you fit into it. And if you're on the king side, that's fine, but understand that you need to think about that as you plan for the future of your firm. If you're a more maybe more collaborative person who can share authority, then that has another implication for how your firm may be formed. Okay, next slide, please. Now, the owner's proclivities also have a lot to do with the kind of firm that you generally begin to form, even if in the beginning of your firm it is completely opportunistic. Things come to you based on who you are, who you know, what your capabilities are, and it may seem like it's coming out of the blue, but who you are makes these kinds of opportunities come to you. So you may look at your own firm and see whether it has been formed in the as one of these business models that are up on this slide right now. Efficiency, experience, or expertise. Next slide, please. Efficiency-based firms make their money by delivering projects quickly and less expensively because they're really focused on efficient processes. Now, you can grow a really large firm with an efficiency-based model, like Mulvaney G2 in Seattle, that grew to 200, 300 people by doing Costco's and tilt-up warehouses, and the only non-routine parts are the parking lot or this site planning. Next slide, please. Many firms will see themselves as experience-based firms, where their experience is in designing complex problems, in solving complex design problems, not necessarily in one project type, although that may be the case as well. In an experience-based firm, you have a mixed staffing triangle. You need all three people, and the way you make money is by excellently managing who is doing what. And that's why it's hard to make money in an experience-based firm, because if a principal is doing what a project manager can do, you're losing money. If a project manager is doing what an intern can do, you're losing money. So management of human resources becomes critical in an experience-based firm. Then an expertise-based firm is the next slide. And in expertise-based firms, the leaders have special knowledge and talent, and most of the work is done by the leaders in the firm. So you need fewer project architects and fewer interns. And basically, they make money through high hourly rates, which they can charge because they know something that nobody else knows. But they have to stay ahead of the curve, be knowledge creators, researchers, innovators, in order to maintain this position of experts. So the next slide is the business matrix model showing kind of how these design models relate to whether you're a generalist or a specialist, or whether you're involved in complex projects or routine projects. And then, of course, we have any project that comes through the door, which it's only disadvantage being that you may become a good generalist, but you may never be able to break out of routine type project. I have a poll. Do we have time for this?
Yeah, I think it's valuable. We'll run through it pretty quickly here, and okay. We'll see it on the screen if I can pull up my controls here. Let's see.
So we have a poll for you to think about, which business model your firm is operating in right now. And so we just have three easy questions for you to answer. And the first one is about your client's most important reason for hiring you. A, reasonable fees while delivering a good product on time. B, a strong portfolio of similar projects. Or C, specialized knowledge or ability that the client needs.
All right, so we'll wait for a few more votes to pull in there so we can see. We have only about 30% of you right now voted. So go ahead and give us a better sample. Go ahead and choose one of those, and we'll share those results to kind of get a feeling for where you fall. This is a cool little poll, because at the end you're going to see where you fall in that sort of experiments pyramid that Rena shared earlier. So I'm going to go ahead and close this off here, and we're getting some more answers there. And let's show you guys. There's our answers up on the screen.
Okay. So almost 40% on A. Okay.
Rena, at your cue, you want me to do the next one?
Yep.
Okay, so this is your definition of professional success.
Okay, your definition of professional success is delivering good projects with effectiveness and grace, winning design awards for large or complex projects, being renowned for your expertise or design talent.
All right. We're getting there. Going to wait for a few more answers to roll in here and get a good representative sample. Looks like we're split down the middle between A and C. So I'm going to close up this poll here and let you all see the responses there.
Wow. Okay.
All right, so let's go on to the next question here.
Your ideal workplace will be acquiring projects and overseeing their execution by staff, working in sync with like-minded people, or surrounded by colleagues who are intellectual peers.
So, and the second choice there, the rest of it, because I couldn't get all the words on there, working in sync with like-minded people on interesting projects in a collegial atmosphere. And the last one, surrounded by colleagues who are intellectual peers capable of collaborating.
All right.
So we'll wait for those to roll in here. We're almost getting up to about 60% of you have voted. Thank you for your votes. And we'll see where we sit here. So let's take a look at these responses here. Okay.
All right. Okay. 27% being 53 and 20. Interesting. Okay. So, bring up the next slide and you'll have a chance to see your answers, which I hope you noted down. Click the first.
Oh, there you go.
Right. So if you had two or more A answers, it's likely that you're actually efficiency-based. You know, even if your third one, your ideal workplace wasn't about acquiring projects and managing others to do them, if your first two were A's, you're probably actually working in that realm and should think about whether, you know, that is really being satisfying to you, or if you, you know, can just be realistic about what you need to do to make your business model more effective and to make more money, just probably taking more responsibility for managing other people doing their work. Okay, next one. B's are experience-based, and interestingly enough, there were very few B's in Q, which maybe has to do with my formation of the question, if this is anything, But if you had two B's, it's like that you're experience-based, and it's interesting that there were so few B's on number two, because most firms, when I ask this in live audiences, will say that they are experience-based firms and are kind of unwilling to admit their efficiency. It might be efficiency-based firms, because somehow that isn't as good. But it's actually a great way to make money, you know, in our firm, in our industry. So think about, you know, what's best for you. And then three are expertise-based firms. And it's not surprising that fewer of you might identify yourself this way, because it's really about having advanced knowledge in a narrow area of our practice. Okay. So, can I go on? I'm almost done. the next slide, Nick. I know we're running over a little, but I'm getting there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the, again, going back to the new science and how leaders affect everybody else in their firms. And neuroscientists have discovered these parts of our brain, these cells in our brain called mirror neurons. And what they do is they make us as individuals naturally imitate the people around us, especially the ones we admire and are our leaders. So the emotional signals, the way that you feel, the way you behave, all these things are going to be copied by the people who are in your firm. And if they're doing things that are not satisfying to you, it could be that you're giving them messages that you don't know about, and it's worthwhile thinking about what kinds of messages you're given. And interestingly enough, the research has discovered that it's more about your attitude and your positiveness than even the words you say. So if you give somebody positive feedback about how great they're doing, but your body language and your words are very, your facial expression are very negative, that will actually not be a positive effect on them. Whereas, you know, if you, in a very good-natured way, give them negative feedback, they'll actually be able to hear it better. So there's this sense of the importance of positiveness, of having having a good state of mind, a positive state of mind, to create a good atmosphere of culture. And part of that, next slide, please, is understanding, you know, I mean, people talk about walking your talk all the time, but it's so critical in our small architectural firms because and going back to the new science and something known as field theory again, which are fields are non-material influences like gravity or a magnetic field, that many believe that we create fields with our personalities and our ways of leadership, and that the field of leaders, you know, create an atmosphere. And we can always feel that, you know, when we go into an office or into any kind of a workplace, even a restaurant, we can feel the atmosphere and the culture that's created. Or people seem happy, or do people seem fearful? These are the kinds of things that have a tremendous effect on the operations of our firms, going back to this basic notion that satisfaction and engagement are reinforcing our ability to produce and make money. So it isn't so this notion that you have to be kind of mean as a leader or a business owner is really just the opposite of the truth in terms of being successful or professional practice. So this last slide shows the summary slide of the kinds of things that you want to think about as a leader, being self-aware, knowing yourself, and spending time coaching and appreciating people for their skills, appreciating people for their impact on others, and appreciating people for their character, you know, their integrity and honesty, and for doing what they say they're going to do. Okay, next slide. So I just want to finish by saying that that the business planning and business operating processes are really not that dissimilar than the kinds of thinking and processes that we use to design our building. Design thinking is business thinking. And I think it's critical for us to be aware of that as architects, that business thinking is not foreign from what we do. It's about systems thinking, it's about understanding people, it's about understanding processes and seeing the whole and planning, you know, from our goals and our visions all the way to our actions. Last slide. And if we do that, we can begin to move from quadrant 4 in this slide where we thought we'd be, I think, most of us, after architecture school, you know, maybe not making much money, but enjoying our work. But unfortunately, many of my colleagues end up in quadrant 3, where they're not enjoying their work and they're not making much money, or even in quadrant 2, where maybe they're making a lot of money, but they're not enjoying their work because of poor work-life balance or other issues. So I'm hoping that my work will help all of you move into quadrant 1, having both high profit, having good compensation, and also having satisfactory and meaningful work life. So next slide, that concludes our course. And one more slide, this is my contact information. I don't think we have time for questions. But if you have any...
We can work in a couple. We'll... Okay. We do have some space between sessions, and we'll probably push OSHA's just back just a slight bit, just so we can answer and have a little bit of answering of some questions here. So let me pull up our questions. One of the questions was, do you have any recommendations for, or what's your favorite, like, project management software?
Well, the answer to that question isn't as easy as it sounds, because it sort of depends on the size of your firm and what you want to do with it. There's basically two kinds. There's a project management software where the accounting and the project management are integrated, so your firm accounting and your project management are, you know, work together and are integrated seamlessly. And those are products like Ajira by Axiom, which was just acquired by Dell Tech, which is the other product, but usually too big or expensive for smaller firms. There's also BillQuick, which has an integrated accounting module, but it's optional. And BillQuick will sync with QuickBooks, which means that you don't have to transfer all your accounting information into the new software. You can just use it basically as a project management software, tracking your project, and it will talk to QuickBooks to allow for your accounting to be updated based on project transactions. Other than that, there's ArchiOffice. There are some web-based ones like Presto AE. There's some only project management software like Basecamp, which is more of a collaborative tool. There's Time. There's Spreadsheet. Timesheet software called Tick, and I think their website is tickspot.com, which is an electronic software for keeping track of your hours. And if you've got, it has a bit of a rudimentary project management by phase, where you can track, you know, how many hours you've done based on an average hourly cost. So those are the general.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rina. Let's see here. So you had some very good comments. People, sounds like they really enjoyed it. Rick was asking if they can get a copy of the slides. Is that possible, Rina?
Yes. If you email me, I'd be happy to send you a copy of the slides. Absolutely.
Okay. We can put a link. We can probably make a PDF of that and put it on the recorded page for people that missed this session to be able to view that as well.
Okay.
So I'm just looking at any other questions here. I'm kind of going back because there were some questions earlier on. I want to make sure we hit anything that jumps out at me here. And I know our next panelist is on the line, so we're getting ready to go. Let's see.
Sorry,
here.
We had to go through this pretty quickly because of our delay. So
yep.
Zoom through it. And again, if you want to uncopy the slides or have any other questions that you want to address me personally, please feel free to email me, and I'd be happy to do that.
Luis had a question here regarding that interesting chart you showed, Rina, about the stagnant profit. And he asks, mm-hmm. Does that suggest it's time to hire more staff?
No, I would not draw that conclusion from that. I think it's time to look at the effectiveness of the work processes and where time is being wasted and how. And it also might be a matter of looking at the staff balance in relation to your business model. So, for instance, you'll see that kind of pattern a lot when the principal isn't delegating to project managers enough. So the principal is doing a lot of the project work themselves, and then it has to be billed out at a higher hourly rate, and the fee for the project gets used up really quickly, and suddenly you have then you have a lot of indirect labor, which goes into your expenses, and you begin to have a chart like this. So you know, it has to be there. You know, it may indicate a need to hire more people, but that certainly would be the first conclusion that I would draw.
Okay, great. All right, and then we will go ahead and put notes in the replay. When you guys go to your account on businessofarchitecture.com, we'll add the notes about some of the softwares that Rina mentioned. Could you spell out the timesheet software? There was a question about that from Andy.
It's called Tick, T-I-C-K, and their website is tickspot, tickspot.com.
Okay, great. And then regarding, you mentioned some of the invoicing softwares. You said one was BillQuick, and Jun Tao Lin was asking about the other two.
ArchiOffice, which is actually a BillQuick product, but a little bit more oriented towards architectural firms. Axiom, I mean, Ajira by Axiom. Is that the other one that I mentioned? Ajira is A-G-E-R-A. And then Presto, which I'm not sure I know how to spell, P-R-E-A-S-T-O. Presto AE is a web-based project management software.
Yep. All right. Well, Rena, thank you for your time. You do have a lot of positive comments here. I'll go ahead and read some of them out. Bruce Mitchison from Down New Zealand says, you nailed it. Jess Stafford, earlier in your slide showing the sort of confusion that happens sometimes when the principal's not around or there's miscommunication, he brought up the Architext website, which is a funny comic that's sort of pretty cynical about some of the things that happen in our firms and in architecture firms. But Yazid from Dubai says, fantastic points, very positive. And Josh says, excellent point about perfection versus just getting it good enough, a great distinction to make to employees and then also to ourselves.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you bet. So I'm just going to pull up your last slide here so people can see your information there. And as Rena mentioned, she does have the book, Architect's Guide to Small Firm Management, which I own. And then there is her contact information. Rena, any last words for the participants?
Just that, you know, small firms are, you can make them what you want them to be. You know, why do it if you can't create it in a way that's satisfying and meaningful for you? So I, you know, good luck to all of you, and I know you can all do it.